All right, we start this evening's class, the first regathering, at session 32, page 234 in your notebook. So let's do a quick review regarding last week. Last week we saw that Anwar Sadat, president of Egypt, had the courage and the will to come to Israel after the 1973 war and speak to the Knesset and speak words of peace. And of course, like I said last week, any Arab nation that extends its hands in peace to Israel, Israel will be right there. The Israelis want peace. So the result was negotiations, tough negotiations between Begin and Sadat, negotiations that required a mediator, and President Jimmy Carter. There you go. Jimmy Carter. Helped intercede, and soon a statement of principles was hammered out, and then after months of more frantic negotiations, finally Begin and Sadat signed a peace treaty on the White House lawn, a peace treaty that has now lasted 30 years. If it will continue, that would be great, but right now it's been a successful peace treaty. Right about that time, President Saddam Hussein of Iraq decided, our good local, fun-filled local dictator, decided that he would like to take the lead in the Arab world by going nuclear. So he began to move toward a nuclear Iraq. Well, of course, that needed to be stopped, and so the Israelis put together the mission to bomb the Osirik reactor that could produce nuclear bomb material, fissionable material. Remember, they left from the Etzion Air Base at 1600 hours, flying low over the Gulf of Aqaba. They flew directly over King Hussein's yacht, much to their surprise and his surprise, I'm sure. And then swiftly over to Iraq to bomb the Osirik reactor, very accurately, by the way. The initial bombs blowing holes in the reactor cover, and then the other bombs going right through those holes and destroying everything in this path. Then, of course, the aircraft flew to a higher altitude and returned home, returning to the Etzion Air Base at 1,600 hours. So that's at 1,900 hours. So from 1,600 hours to 1,900 hours, 16, 17, 18, 19, three-hour mission. A three-hour mission that was incredibly successful, which caused the world to scream at Israel publicly but privately to shake their hands. Yes, question. I am sure the Israelis will stop the Iranian nuclear march some way.
Yeah.
I don't think it'll probably be through an aircraft bombing incident, because the distance, this stretched the aircraft to their limit already. But who knows? They've got something planned, yeah. I'm sure. I'm sure they're working on something, yes.
Is it true that a few years ago they screwed up the Iranian nuclear plant through the computer?
Yes, the Stuxnet virus is attributed now to the United States and Israel, and that did some damage in Iran, yes. And it's still around, I guess. All right, so there was the bombing of the Osirik reactor. Israel then completed its programmed withdrawal from the Sinai. Remember this map? We saw the territory occupied by Israel after the 73 war. Here is the no man's land, the border between Syria and Israel in the Golan Heights, a no man's land that still holds today, that's never been violated, but we now have Islamic militants all along that border, so we'll see what happens in the years to come, months to come, days to come. Then in 1975, Israel moved back approximately one-third, gave back approximately one-third of the Sinai to Egypt. Then in 1980, the second phase of the withdrawal took place, two-thirds of the Sinai was returned to Egypt, and finally in 1982, the third withdrawal and the third redeployment and all of the Sinai was now returned to Egypt, right on schedule. Well, the southern border was peaceful, but the northern border with Lebanon was red hot, with Hezbollah throwing rockets into the Galilee settlements. A particularly heavy rocket barrage of Nahariya caused the IDF, by Katyusha rockets, by the way, these are Russian rockets, caused the IDF to put into operation Operation Peace for Galilee. They were originally going to just carve out a safety zone 25 miles deep along the southern Lebanese border, but they went ahead and pushed further all the way up to Beirut. And this map summarizes Operation Peace for Galilee for you in the legend. Since Beirut was now under siege, this gave Ariel Sharon the opportunity he sought to put into Operation Big Pines, in which he decided to destroy the PLO. And it was a long, lengthy war, besieging Beirut. But when it was over, the Syrian army and the PLO, which were in southern Lebanon, were now pushed out, and the PLO was out of Beirut. The Druze militia and the Shia militias, both friendly toward Israel, had taken control of southern Lebanon. And so the southern Lebanese borders became a bit quieter. At that time, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, your friendly neighborhood terrorist, started the organization called Hamas that we know so much about today. And I had you read about Hezbollah and Hamas on your own in the notebook. And so now we'll pick it up on page 234 with the beginning of the Intifada. Question?
Doesn't he look like Mark Spellman?
Like who?
Mark Spellman.
Who? I'm sorry, I'm not... Is this a TV personality or somebody? I don't... Okay, well, I'm... He's an actor. Well, I am culturally...
Yes,
of deprived, so I'm not quite up on all these... Okay. Poor Marty Feldman. They were scattered throughout the Arab world. Okay. All right, page 234. The Intifada begins. Remember, Intifada is an Arab word meaning shaking off. And the idea here is we're going to shake off the Israeli oppressors. That's the idea. So on December 9th, 1987, an uprising known as the Intifada began in the Gaza Strip. Before too long, it had expanded throughout the Arab population areas of the West Bank as well. It was led by young Palestinians for four reasons. Reason number one, they despaired of the prolonged Israeli occupation. We don't have a country of our own. Secondly, they were frustrated by the political deadlock between the PLO and Israel. Everything was at a standstill. Thirdly, they had their own frustrations with both the local Palestinian leadership and that of the PLO. The PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, has been corrupt to the core from the beginning. It's corrupt to the core today. Yasser Arafat shipped millions off to Swiss bank accounts. His wife, his widow, lives in absolute luxury in Europe now, living on the millions that he stole from the UN and the Europeans and America. And they lined their pockets, and the Palestinian street suffered. And so they were very frustrated with that as well. And finally, these young Palestinians despaired over the failure of the Arab states to resolve their plight. The Arab states were now getting indifferent to the Palestinians, and getting losing interest in the Palestinian cause. And so they needed to elevate the Palestinian cause to a higher level. The snapping point came on December 9th when an Israeli truck ran over four Arab workers from the Gaza region as they returned from work in Israel. 3 days earlier, an Israeli merchant had been stabbed to death in Gaza, and a rumor ran among the Arab population that the traffic accident was really an Israeli act of revenge. So based on that little bit of gossip, attacks on Israeli soldiers and civilians then commenced. Arab residents of the West Bank used whatever weapons were available to them, most attacked by throwing rocks. And believe me, folks, they were not pebbles. Go right through your windshield and smash your skull. Okay? Even today, this is happening. However, knives, hatchets, gasoline bombs, and even grenades were brought into play. Arab villages tried to prevent the entry of Israeli soldiers. Arab school children were encouraged to become actively involved by hurling stones as well as abuse. Well, remember, the PLO started using children in 73. Here is a picture from the Intifada, and this is a Palestinian schoolboy And you can see he's hurling abuse at Israel by displaying the Palestinian flag and saying, you know, we're going to get you guys. So there's an example of school children being used to fight in the battle, fight the cause. The Israeli army struggled to retain control. Israeli troops broke up demonstration and attacks using tear gas, rubber, and plastic bullets. Only under extreme provocation was live ammunition brought into play. So under conditions like this, it was inevitable that excesses should occur, and several Israeli soldiers were found guilty of abusing their powers. Israel doesn't stand for that. When there is an abuse like that, they call their soldiers to task. And so a number of them who violated proper behavior were found guilty and punished for abusing their powers. That does not happen in the PLO. The dangers became more acute when stabbing of Jews spread to the Jewish urban areas. Arabs accused of collaboration with the authorities suffered murder and mutilation by their fellow Arabs. For example, between January 1991 and April 1993, that's 2.5 years, 150 Israeli soldiers and civilians were killed. In the Intifada, okay, 1,500 Palestinians were killed by their own brethren. The same 2.5 years. 1,500 Arabs killed by fellow Arabs. And only 151 Israelis. You wonder why. And, you know, abused too. Mutilated. I've seen videos of, fairly recent videos of this still happening, where a bunch of motorcyclists drug a body of a man through Gaza City. And somebody was just filming it. You know? So this kind of abuse and mutilation is still going on. But by April of 1993, the fires of the Intifada had all but burned themselves out. Okay, bottom of page 234, it says 1989, the four-point peace initiative. The details are found in the top of page 235. The onset of the Intifada in December 1987 and the decision by the Reagan administration to enter into a dialogue with the PLO in December of 1988 placed Israel in a difficult position, forcing its government to come up with a new peace initiative. This initiative, announced on May 14, 1989, called for negotiations with the Palestinians for an interim agreement based on the Camp David autonomy plan. Now, that was part of the Egypt-Israel peace treaty. Remember, Egypt said, we've got to solve the Palestinian problem. And Begin agreed to that, so he's trying to implement that right now. At the end of a 5-year transition period, discussions would be held for the final resolution of the issues. Now, the U.S. welcomed the plan as a very useful step, but the PLO and King Hussein of Jordan rejected it. On October 8th, the U.S. tried again. U.S. Secretary of State James Baker proposed a 5-point plan of talks between Israel and the Palestine delegation in Cairo. On November 5th, Israel's inner cabinet gave conditional approval to Baker's 5-point peace initiative. The U.S. must provide assurances that there will be no negotiations with the PLO. However, the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry. On August 2nd, 1990, the Iraqi army invaded Kuwait, plunging the world into a crisis that far overshadowed the Arab-Israeli situation. The face of peace would be completely altered in its aftermath. Major event for the Middle East. Mass immigration of Soviet Jews. Popular uprisings, economic collapse, and free elections ousted communist governments in much of Eastern Europe in 1989 and 1990. A failed hardline coup against Soviet President Gorbachev led to the suspension of the Communist Party in the USSR and the country's subsequent disintegration in 1991. Now, today, the current Russian president, Vladimir Putin, gives his opinion of what happened in 1991. He is noted for saying that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a major political disaster of the century. He doesn't like it. Russia lost her power and glory. And he's busy now trying to rebuild that, isn't he? Busy trying to rebuild that. So that's Putin's view of the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. But what was bad for Russia was good for Israel. Very good for Israel. The result, massive Jewish immigration from the Soviet Union starting in 1989. By early 1993, the number of Soviet immigrants totaled 420,000. The peak years were 1990 and 1991. And notice how the immigration increases. Immigrant count in 1989, 12,932. That's 13,000 Soviet Jewish people came to the country. 1990, 185,227. Great jump there. Immigrant count in 1991, 147,839. And then it begins to drop off at that point. 1992, 65,000 were Soviet Jews. So this is a major aliyah that happened in the early 90s. And I think you can see that Russian Jewish immigration has had a big impact on the modern state of Israel, starting way back with the Chovev Etzion. Remember way, way back early in our course, 30-some sessions ago, the Chovev Etzion started in Russia in the late 1870s, right up to the present. Russian immigration has a big impact on Israel. But the Russian Aliyah of the early 90s was a mixed blessing. There was a bright side and a drawback to it all. The blessing was these thousands and thousands of new immigrants coming in. That was a great blessing. But the drawback was that they also brought with them a lot of the Russian vices. The mafia, prostitution, things like that. These Russian immigrants were secular, atheistic Jewish people that came out of communism, that were raised under communism, raised under atheism. And so these problems, a lot of social problems suddenly flourished in Israel as these Russian Jews came in. Now, it was a heady time back then when the Russian Jews were coming out of Russia, not only going to Israel, but going to Europe and going to the United States. And I remember the many of the Jewish missions that were in Russia or in Eastern Europe at that time. These people were hungry for Bibles. They knew Bibles existed, but they'd never seen any. And they used to bring in truckloads of Bibles, and they'd be emptied in 15 minutes. They'd be mobbed. They'd be mobbed for these Bibles. And many of them did become believers. A number of Russian Jewish congregations in New York City, for example, got started at this time. And we at Ariel Ministries, we were involved in a Russian camp up at Camp Shoshana, trying to teach these brand new Russian immigrants the Bible. That was an exciting time then, difficult time too. I remember at camp, they would bring their Russian culture in to camp, and things got a little hairy sometimes. And sometimes we needed translators that weren't so good. You know, I remember one translator, the Russians that did know English, came to us and said, "The translator is translating everything exact opposite of what the teacher stated. We had to get rid of that guy, you know." But it was quite a time when these Russian Jewish immigrants were coming in. So Ariel had Russian camp going on at that time. So that was quite a privilege to be part of that at Camp Shoshana. Okay, well, let's move on. 1991. Iraq attacks Israel. Page 236. Israel's small size, her proximity to Arab states that since 1948 have refused to make peace with her, made her particularly vulnerable to air and missile attack. In August 1990, Iraq invaded and annexed Kuwait, which it had long claimed. "It's our territory," said good old Saddam. The UN Security Council called for Iraq to withdraw and subsequently embargoed most trade with Iraq. January 17, 1991, a U.S.-led coalition that included Britain, Egypt, France, Saudi Arabia, and other nations began a massive air war to destroy Iraq's forces and military and civil infrastructure. Many of us remember that in 1991. Iraq called for terrorist attacks against the coalition and launched missiles at Israel in an unsuccessful attempt to widen the war and break up the coalition. See, their plan was to attack Israel, so Israel would attack them, And now they hoped the other Arab nations in the coalition would refuse to fight on Israel's side and would break up the coalition because Israel is now attacking an Arab country as well. That was his plan of attack. That was his strategy. So Iraqi missiles fell on Tel Aviv, Ramat Gan, and Haifa. Now, urged to do so by Western nations, Israel refrained from retaliation, even in self-defense. So Israel did not fall for the trap, and the coalition remained intact, and Saddam Hussein was defeated. In all, 30 Scud missiles hit Israel. Some were destroyed in the air by American-manned Patriot anti-missile missiles that were located near Tel Aviv. 4,000 Israeli apartments were totally destroyed. One civilian, 51-year-old Eitan Grunlund, was killed when the missile hit his home in Ramat Aviv on January 25, 1991. So that's quite amazing. 4,000 apartments were totally destroyed, 30 Scud missiles, and only one fatality. Only one fatality. So that's the bright side of the attack. Okay, the map on page 237 is a map showing you Israel, the aerial threat, and the Gulf War. And if you look at the map, you can see how close, how tiny an area the Levant is here. Look at Iraq, Air Base H3. It's only 35 minutes to Jerusalem. 35 minutes, that's all. Down at the bottom of the page, Saudi Arabia, the Tabuk airfield, 18 minutes to Eilat. That's not much time. Not much time to get ready against an enemy. From Amman, Jordan, you see Amman in the middle there? To Jerusalem, 6 minutes. From Damascus to Galilee, 7 minutes airtime. You wonder why Israel is on edge and why she constantly has her eyes peering at the Arab nations close to her. Well, anyway, this is the map you have on page 237, and we read this this legend up in the corner there is the area that I read for you. So if anyone ever asks you why Israel is on the alert all the time, take them to this map. Show them there's only a few minutes warning they have. Okay, page 238. The Middle East Peace Conference in Madrid. The Gulf War and the political collapse of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics remolded the fundamental shape of politics in the Middle East. The modification in the political foundation of the region led to a reassessment by the Arab world of its relationship toward the State of Israel. The Arab nations re-examined Israel's offer to enter into mutual peace negotiations and chose to collaborate with Israel in building a fresh future for the region. October 1991, a meeting under Soviet and American auspices was assembled in Madrid, Spain, for the purpose of beginning direct face-to-face negotiations. The Madrid conference called together the appropriate nations for an opening interchange. The purpose was to inaugurate discussions regarding two independent and related subjects. Two-party discussions and collective discussions began. So you've got two basic divisions to this conference, a two-party division and a collective division. The conference was simply an opening forum for all the participants. The Madrid conference had no power to force solutions or to prohibit agreements. Now, the two-party talks, two-party section, that was geared to the resolution of the conflicts of the past. The collective section aimed at developing the region for the future. So as a result of the Madrid conference, direct discussions between Israel and Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and the Palestinians began November 3, 1991. These talks boiled down to four independent sets of two-party negotiations. The negotiations with Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan were designed to heal the injuries of the past and result in treaties of peace. That was the goal. Peace treaties. The discussions between Israel and the PLO are different in aim and scope. The consultations between Israel and the Palestinians contain a three-step approach. The first step is geared to designing a transitional self-governing agreement with the Palestinians. The second step involves a 5-year implementation period of those agreements. The third step, negotiations will concentrate on permanent self-government issues. So the collective talks were designed to stabilize and build up the region for the long-term future. Now, the bargaining will deal with 5 key issues in concern to the entire Middle East: water utilization, environmental protection, military arms control and national security, refugee status, and the economic progress of the entire area. All right, on page 239, you have this chart. So this chart will summarize the Madrid conference. This is the plan that was put together. You can see it divided into the two-party talks and the collective talks. And under two-party talks, you can see that Israel was to discuss a peace treaty with Lebanon and with Syria. Notice no peace treaty has been implemented between those two countries and Israel. She was to discuss a peace treaty with Jordan. That was successful. It was signed in 1994. And then with the Palestinians, a little different track, putting together a transitional self-government, a 5-year implementation period, and then permanent self-government. So that's the two-party talks and the most important talks, the collective talks dealing with water, environment, arms, security, and economics, and refugees. It seems sometimes almost silly to go over this material when we realize how poorly this thing has been implemented, how little progress has been made since 1991. Just pitifully little progress, but little progress has been made. But there it is. Those were the high hopes. Those were the dreams. Back in 1991, everybody thought things would be different. So it's sad. All right, 1992. Diplomatic relations established with China and India, two emerging nations of important size and status, and they both recognized Israel as a solid diplomatic partner. New government headed by Yitzhak Rabin and the Labor Party. The Labor Party is going to come back into prominence now after being shadows, and the Likud Party being in the spotlight. The Labor Party of Yitzhak Rabin won a clear victory in elections held June 23, 1992. Rabin called for peace and reconciliation with Israel's Arab neighbors. All right, now at this point. I wanted to show you part 5 of our DVD from Israel, A Nation Is Born, hosted by Foreign Minister Abba Eban. It covered the area, the time frame we just looked at, 1973 to 1991. But this is a 1-hour DVD, so we will look at it next week. So next week, bring your popcorn. You want to stay here till a whole extra half hour? No. I wish you guys would get it straight out there, what you want to do. I need to get home. All right, one vote. That's mine. All right, so next week, bring your popcorn, bring your ice cream, whatever, and we'll settle down to Tuesday night at the movies, and we'll watch Section 5 from 1973 to 1991. For the rest of our time together, we will move on, and we'll pick it up on page 240. And I see that it is 7:45. It's time for your break. So go ahead and take your break, and we'll pick it up at the top of page 240 with 1993. So go ahead and take your break. All right, let's start again on page 240 of your notebook. And the year is 1993, Declaration of Principles. Now, ongoing peace talks produced historic agreements between Israel and the Palestinian Liberation Organization in September 1993. The latter recognized Israel's right to exist publicly, never privately, though. The latter recognized Israel's right to exist, and Israel recognized the PLO as the representative of the Palestinians. The two sides then signed, on September 13th, an agreement for limited Palestinian self-rule in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank, beginning with the city of Jericho. And here is that agreement being put together with the help of President Clinton. So Rabin on the left and Yasser Arafat on the right. This is an agreement for limited self-rule. You have this picture on page 241 of your notebook. The agreement was known as the Israeli-Palestinian Declaration of Principles. So here's the basic idea. Washington, D.C., September 13th. Stage one, you see, is the self-governing arrangements. Stage two is to move to permanent status. So this is the beginning of a chart we're going to work through. The next day, Israel and Jordan signed a framework accord intended to pave the way for a future peace treaty. That agreement, known as the Common Agenda, includes the following components: security, water, refugees and displaced persons, borders, and territorial matters. In addition, the parties agreed to explore the potential for future cooperation in regional issues such as economy and tourism, natural resources, and human resources. Now, since the Madrid conference, talks between Israel and Syria have been carried out. Israel has stated that she's willing to consider an element of withdrawal on the Golan Heights in the context of a peace settlement. Prime Minister Rabin stated that should a peace treaty that includes a significant withdrawal from the Golan Heights be negotiated with Syria, the proposed treaty will be put to a national referendum, a national vote, before it is signed. Well, needless to say, that has never happened. Never happened. There were high hopes at one time, and there's a lot of concern about that among the Israeli population. That's why he was saying the populace, the men on the street, will vote for or against that peace treaty. All right, page 241, Gaza-Jericho Agreement. Shortly after signing the Declaration of Principles, negotiations commenced in Cairo and Paris between Israeli and PLO delegations on the implementation of the first stage of the interim agreement. The negotiations were completed after 7 months of discussions. The Gaza-Jericho Agreement was signed in Cairo May 4, 1994. It applies to the Gaza Strip and to a defined area of about 65 square kilometers, including Jericho and its suburbs. Israel is responsible for external security, while the Palestinians are responsible for public order and internal security. The following points were also included: withdrawal of Israeli forces, security of Israelis, security of roads, safe passage, Palestinian prisoner release, legal matters, economic relations, and transfer of civil affairs to the Palestinian Authority. On the 29th of August, the agreement on preparatory transfer of powers in the West Bank was implemented. The Palestinian Authority assumed responsibility for education, culture, health, social welfare, tourism, and taxation. And I was in Israel for the very, very first time in 1994 with Dr. Fruchtenbaum and his five-week study tour. And on the day that Israel withdrew from Jericho, we were scheduled to go into Jericho. Instead, the Palestinian flag was raised at that town, and we were not allowed to go in. And it was a big disappointment to me on two levels. First of all, not to be able to go into the archaeological ruins of Jericho, but secondly, to see that Palestinian flag flying. Yeah. It just pierced me to the heart. It still does. It still bugs me when I get near the West Bank and I see the Palestinian flag flying. It just doesn't fit. But anyway, I will always remember that day because the timing was so perfect in the negative sense. Yes, G2.
On the West Bank in Gaza, what kind of currency are they using? Islamic currency?
What kind of currency are they using? I'm not sure what kind they are using in Gaza or the West Bank. So I can't answer that question. I can't answer that question. American dollars for sure. American dollars are welcome just about everywhere. Anyway, I don't know. I'd have to look that up. All right. Page 242. Now, on page 242, you see the beginning of a chart that we will build step by step as each column of that chart is implemented. So you can see on the far left-hand side, it's the Gaza-Jericho Agreement, which included the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza and Jericho, and the transfer of powers and responsibilities to a Palestinian authority. The agreement included security arrangements, transfer of civil affairs, legal framework, and economic framework. So that's stage one of the Gaza-Jericho agreement, and you can see it on your chart. All right, let's move on to the Israel-Jordan peace treaty in the middle of page 242. King Hussein of Jordan and Prime Minister Rabin declared an end to the state of war between the two countries in Washington on July 25th, 1994. So a formal Israel-Jordan peace treaty was signed October 26, 1994. And that peace treaty, here it is being signed, King Hussein on the left, Bill Clinton in the middle, and Yitzhak Rabin on the right. That peace treaty has held for all these years as well. So that's been good. How long it will last, I don't know. But as long as we have a moderate government in Jordan, the peace treaty should hold. So that's a good bright spot, one of the few bright spots in the negotiations with the Palestinians and the plans from the Madrid conference. All right, page 243. Below the picture, on the 29th of August, the agreement on preparatory transfer of powers in the West Bank was implemented. And again, you can see column 2 is now exposed, and that's the next step in the negotiation with the Palestinians, transfer of powers. The early transfer of powers and responsibilities in specified spheres in those parts of the territories not included in the Gaza-Jericho Agreement. Education and culture, health, social welfare, direct taxation, tourism, and other spheres as agreed. So the negotiations are moving along. Now, page 244, top of the page, Nobel Prize. Yeah, groaner. This is the groaner of the year. This is the groaner of the year. Amid caustic criticism, the 1994 Nobel Peace Prize, was awarded to Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, Foreign Minister Shimon Peres, and our friendly neighborhood terrorist, PLO leader Yasser Arafat.
Peace was his middle name, right?
Peace was his middle name, right. There you go, right. Yasser Arafat, the guy who invented the hijacking of commercial airliners and encouraged the youth of children in war and spoke in Arabic to the Palestinians saying, "We will destroy Israel," and spoke in English to everybody else and saying, "We want peace." This is the biggest farce of the year. Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres in the center, Yitzhak Rabin on the right, both truly want peace. But the guy on the left is a living, walking lie. Say again? I still didn't hear you there. One of these doesn't belong. You're quite right. And the world knew it, and many people criticized the awarding of the Nobel Prize to Yasser Arafat. But I think it was done to give him status, you know, and give him authority, you know, and kind of raise his status in the world. He's the winner of a peace prize. He's a valid partner for peace. But kind of crazy, but it was done. It was done. Kind of makes a mockery of the Nobel Peace Prize, doesn't it? All right, well, so let's go into brighter things, huh? 1995, Hamas and the peace process. The path toward peace has been painful for Arab and Israeli alike. The main problem has been terrorist attacks perpetrated mainly by the Islamic fundamentalist groups such as Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Hezbollah. Hamas was created in 1987 as an offshoot of another group you're very familiar with, the Muslim Brotherhood. You've heard of them, haven't you, in Egypt?
Yes.
Sure. It's an Egyptian-born movement that rejects Western evils and calls for a pan-Islamic religious state. Guess what we're hearing about today? Same thing. A caliphate.
Yes.
The word Hamas means zeal in Arabic. It's also an Arabic acronym for Harakat al-Mukama al-Islamiyya, the Islamic resistance movement. Theologically, they believe that Islam must rule in the Holy Land and that divine salvation awaits those who destroy Israel. I ask you, is the God of Muhammad the God of the Bible? The God of the Bible loves Israel and says, no matter what, I am going to preserve you. You are the apple of my eye. And yet the God of Muhammad says, kill the Jews. Kill them all. Yeah, many people say they're the same. Stupidity. Anyway, excuse me. That's my editorial comment. All right. Now, the most disturbing element in this terrorism is the fact that Hamas is recruiting and training teenage boys to strap explosives to themselves and become human bombs, the suicide bomber. Hamas terrorism is designed to disrupt the peace process begun between the PLO and Israel. Page 245. The peace process continues to crawl along toward implementation in spite of numerous terrorist attacks. February 1995, 17 months after Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat shook hands on the White House lawn, 116 Israelis have been killed and 400 wounded in terrorist attacks. Lots of peace. The major attacks include such examples as these. December 5, 1993, a resident of a refugee camp in Gaza opens fire on a bus traveling on the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway, killing one Israeli before being shot to death. Islamic Jihad claims responsibility. Afula is located in the Jezreel Valley. Afula, April 16, 1994. A 19-year-old member of Hamas blows up a bus with a car bomb in this northern Israeli town. 9 people are killed. More than 50 others are wounded. And you can read the rest of the examples on page 245. It'll make nice reading. It'll give you nightmares tonight if you do so. But these are just examples of the many, many, many terrorist attacks that were perpetrated on the Israelis during this time period. Page 246. Unfortunately, on page 246, excuse me, in 1994, I don't remember exactly the month. Well, everybody was on high alert, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, everybody was on high alert, and there was a time or two where we got stopped while a suspicious parcel was investigated. So yeah, things were underway. All right, unfortunately, page 246, for the third time, unfortunately, Arab fundamentalists are not the only ones perpetrating terrorist attacks. Fortunately, the Jewish attacks are few. We have our terrorists too, you guys. The most famous is the Purim morning attack in Kiryat Arba by Dr. Baruch Goldstein. Here he is, medical doctor, Dr. Baruch Goldstein. I just can't, in my life, understand why a medical doctor would do what he did. There's a Jewish terrorist. We do have our few terrorists. On February 25th, 1994, Goldstein, dressed in his reserve army uniform, entered the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron, the Cave of Machpelah, at 5:30 in the morning. He fired 111 bullets from his Galil assault rifle into Muslim worshippers before he was beaten to death. So here it is. This is the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron. This is a shared sacred spot because the Arabs also consider the patriarchs their patriarchs as well. Abraham, and he is one of the patriarchs of the Arabs. And so it's kind of, it's a shared religious spot.
Is it that big building?
Yeah. There is a cave in there, yes. We'll go inside in just a second here. There are caves in there, and it is a possible burial ground for the patriarchs. Now, yes, let's go inside the Tomb of the Patriarchs, and this is the inside. And you can see two cenotaphs over, I believe those are over the caves right there. And this is inside, and these are Muslim worshippers bowing, you know, down. And this is where Baruch Goldstein opened fire with his assault rifle.
Is that Abraham's tomb?
Yeah, Machpelah, yeah. Abraham and Sarah. Yeah, our.
So both Jews and Arabs?
Share this, yes.
They do.
Yeah, they consider Hebron a holy town and they share this site.
Did you get in there?
No, I've never been in there. Never been in there. All righty. So, he opened up with his rifle. He was beaten to death. 29 died. Scores were injured. 1 year later, an article in the Jerusalem Report, which is a magazine coming out of Israel, reports that, quote, with the threat of brutal violence ever present, the army has tried to divide Hebron into Jewish and Arab zones. But the separation is a farce. The hatred is pure and transparent. And it's true even to today. There is unreserved hatred by the settlers and by the Arabs in that area. They hate each other. Now, Goldstein was a member of Kach, a militant Orthodox group founded by Rabbi Meir Kahani. Another such group, a splinter group from Kach, is known as Kahani Chai. These groups were outlawed following the Hebron massacre. A less militant group is the Orthodox settlement movement known as the Gush Emunim, the community of believers. While committed to Jewish settlement in the occupied territories, Gush Emunim decries actions as radical as Goldstein's massacre. However, they are committed to the idea of annexation, and that under the covenant between God and Abraham, the right of the Jewish people to Samaria and Judea is incontestable and non-negotiable. So they lead in the settler movement. All right, Lebanon and Hezbollah. The cycle in southern Lebanon continued in 1995. Israel versus the Islamic militants, strike, counterstrike, attack, counterattack. So the all the work going into Operation Peace for Galilee did not bear much fruit. The fundamentalist group most responsible is Hezbollah, page 247. Hezbollah consistently rockets northern Galilee targets, especially the town of Kiryat Shmona. All right, here is on the left a map of Israel with the rectangle highlighting the area we're focusing in on the right. And on the right, in the panhandle, sticking up into Lebanon, you see the town of Kiryat Shmona. This town is right along the border and sits up against a mountain range. It's right at the base of a mountain range. Now, here is a picture of Kiryat Shmona. This is from that western mountain range. Behind the photographer is the Lebanese border. And behind the border is Hezbollah. So you can see how easy it is to lob mortars and rockets into this town. They're on the high ground. Just give it a lob, and it's going to land in the middle of Kiryat Shmona somewhere. So Kiryat Shmona has received its share of bombs and rockets, and the people have had bomb shelters there for many, many years. I've only been in Kiryat Shmona once, and that was in 1994. And we were a little bit on edge. Arnold, is it okay to come into this town? There were no sirens went off when we were there, but they very well could have. These days, most tourists do bypass Kiryat Shmona because it is a very touchy area. So, up there. All right, Russian immigration. We're now on page 247. Russian immigration has slowed to a fraction of its early 90s heyday. According to an article in November 17, 1994, issue of the Jerusalem Report, the current Russian trend is to create a prosperous, assimilated, and generally non-Zionist community. These are Jewish people living in Russia. Although Jewish immigration continues to Israel and America, most Russian Jews plan on staying put. Economics is the key factor. Now, staying means living in a society in which anti-Semitic expressions do occur. But Russia's Jews seem willing to accept that. So there's at least 1 million Jewish people still in Russia today. 1 million still in Russia today. And they do suffer anti-Semitism now and again, especially lately. But they are seeming willingly to stay in place. West Bank. As of this writing, the Rabin government is planning a 276 million separation line between Israel and the West Bank. After last January's suicide bombing at the Beit Lid Junction, Rabin decided that he wanted to curb the Hamas and Islamic Jihad terrorists by putting up a fence to separate Israel proper from the West Bank. The new generation line is set to run along the same route as the old 1967 Green Line, although without redividing Jerusalem. The plan has been prepared and is only waiting the green light from Rabin to start its implementation. In the words of Jerusalem Report correspondent Leslie Susser, it sounds suspiciously like a border. Well, that security fence has gone into place. We'll talk about that more when it gets implemented. But we'll see if it becomes a border or not. All righty. At this point, next week we will have our DVD on 1973 to 1991. And the following week we'll pick it up on page 249 with the Oslo II Accord signed in the White House. Okay, question. Cynthia. This lesson is a compilation of sources, yes.
How long did it take to put together?
It took a bit of work.
Wow.
Yeah, I don't know how long, but as you can see, it's newspaper articles and et cetera and everything else.
You've taken such an awesome thing,
it
just helped us to be able to see it step by step.
Well, I hope it's all clear. We're trying to do it chronologically so you get the flow of what exactly happened. Well, it won't quit. Don't worry. We'll continue. We'll try to get this thing finished. Okay, one more question.
Just out of curiosity, since Israel became a nation, how many wars did they fought?
I have a chart coming up. I think it's 7 at this point. So, let's see. 1948, 1956, 1973, 1967, 1973. Then, 73 Yom Kippur War. Then we've got the incursion into Lebanon and the Intifada, and we've got wars I haven't talked about yet.
Yeah.
I have a chart that'll bring you up to date when we get there. So when we get toward the end of the course, you will have them all listed. Okay, one more question by Marion. What is this? A snake? You wanted to catch my attention.
Do you have to read the article on Shimon Peres, who just retired, I've been meeting with the Pope recently?
No, I haven't read that article.
Well, I'll bring it, but it's quite interesting. He met with the Pope in regards to setting up a United Nations for all the three main religions, and the Pope to head it up.
Yeah, well, interesting. Yes, there will be a one world government and a one world religion in the tribulation.
It's just when you see it.
Yeah, well, it's all the pieces are coming together step by step. All right, let's go ahead and pray. I'll let you guys out 5 minutes early. So you owe me. No, I probably owe you. Okay, let's pray. Father, we thank you for your oversight of the nation Israel as we again look at this history and see how you have sustained your people. Even in disobedience, you have stated that you love your people, you have a covenant relationship, and while you will punish us, you will not let us be destroyed or disappear. So we thank you for that, and we look forward to what you have in the future for the nation of Israel and the Messianic Kingdom, and for the world, for that matter. So bring us back next week, eager to look again into the history of the modern state and see how you have intervened in her life. And we remember, we always want to remember, Lord, that you are in charge of our life as well. Not only the kings and nations of this world, but each one of us in this room is the object of your attention. And we thank you in Yeshua's name. Amen. All right, we'll see you next week.